by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Janet, it has been fantastic. If you have just loved the outdoors of Wyoming lately, daytime or nighttime.
That's right. I mean, you know, we always talk about getting out in the fall and doing fantastic things. We have, you know, hunting and fishing opportunities across the state that are just second to none. But even if you don't love to hunt and fish and you just love Wyoming, this past week with the Northern Lights has just been outstanding. And I got some fantastic pictures of family just standing in the middle of Casper with the lights above them and the Aurora Borealis left nothing behind. It was absolutely fantastic.
Now, Game and Fish has no control over that, right? That you can't you can't throw anything out there about that?
We do, actually. We do. And that's why we spent the entire week, you know, we were on our little bikes pedaling, trying to create enough energy, the solar energy there to spread it across. But no, really, just again, another example of all the fantastic things that Wyoming has to offer for, you know, watchable wildlife and just being outside. And, you know, we talk a lot about the camping experience and everything. And even those who don't do those things could just step outside their door and love Wyoming.
Look for the regulations of Northern Lights in 2026 for Game and Fish.
Absolutely.
Right after fishing. It'll be right in there, right in that area.
But exactly. And we'll make sure not to call it Northern Lights. We'll make it more difficult, like Aurora Borealis, and complicated, so that people will have to struggle to figure out what we're talking about before they know what the new regulations are.
Another opportunity to chat with Game and Fish. That's what I what I love. And, you know, Jenny, you know, we mentioned all of the great things that you can do in Wyoming, whether it is stargazing. That's an awesome thing. And I think that maybe we haven't talked as deeply about how I got to Wyoming, that really, in my opinion, is one of those lifelong dreams. When I was 12, my grandparents brought me on vacation out to the West. We went and stayed all throughout Wyoming and made it out here. And through my life, I would take man trips and come right to Wyoming. It was It was my deal. I grew up in Illinois.
Okay.
And then when I got through my radio career, which has taken me a lot of different places, I ended up in Burlington, Iowa for 9 years. Like, that's the longest I've ever been anywhere in my career.
Okay.
And what I would do is jump on Highway 34, head west, and go through like Ottumwa and all these little towns through Iowa until you get to Highway 29. And that's where I would decide how I would get to Wyoming. Either go up to Omaha or go into Lincoln and get on 80. So, you know, and it was always just a dream of mine to live here because of the opportunities we have. Hunting, fishing, stargazing, all of that. And it's really cool. When I lived in Iowa, I did an outdoor show. So I had an opportunity to interact with a lot of the Iowa outdoor family. And before I moved to Wyoming, I never really knew anything outside of whitetail deer, turkey, and waterfowl. I mean, because that's about all there is in the Midwest for something like that. And then you come out to a state like Wyoming, and it gets just the sky is the limit. And I know that being a part of Game and Fish, you've seen this through your whole life living here.
Absolutely. You know, and we often talk about, you know, how lucky I have been, you know, being born, raised in Wyoming and having an outdoor family who has always provided me that opportunity and experience to be, you know, out of doors. And we have tried that with my kids as well, as, you know, oh, hey, here's, you know, the hunting and fishing side of it, but also the mountain biking, go explore, you know, on your own two wheels, and hiking, and all of those things that are really incredible. And one of the things that's, you know, been really neat for us is, you know, getting to learn your story, Drew, and just how you got here. And while we're talking, you know, we often interject to people, our listeners, that we're looking at each other, right? We can see each other. And our guest today, we can see her as well. And as you're telling the story, seeing her face light up and her wanting to interject in your story has been really incredible, because we have the Wyoming Game and Fish Department's director, Director Angie Bruce, on with us today. And clearly she shares in your experience, Drew, and loving for her to be here and tell her story as well.
Director, welcome. It's so nice of you to join us on this show. And I know being the director of Wyoming Game and Fish Department holds a lot of responsibility. It's, you know, with great power come great responsibility. And it's got to be a pleasure for you to be in that position.
It is. Thank you, Drew. Janet, good to be with you here today. And Janet hit it on the nose, especially, Drew, when you were talking about crossing Iowa on Highway 34. So I grew up 1 mile south of that highway in Red Oak, Iowa. So definitely got a little goosebumps as you talked about your history and how you strive to get out to Wyoming. And very similar path. Couldn't have said it any better than you, Drew. And yes, being the director of Wyoming Game and Fish is a huge honor for me. Just an incredible honor to get to represent such a great agency, but an agency that Wyomingites just automatically respect is just been incredible. The people in this state have naturally passed that respect on to me, and it's actually been a little bit shocking for me, a lot to handle, because I don't feel that I've earned it in a lot of their faces yet. And when they automatically treat me with that way, it's incredible. It shows you how much the people who live here respect and honor the great fish and wildlife resources that we have.
And, you know, I would like to contradict you a little bit here, Director. I do feel like you have 100% earned the respect and you know, admiration of a lot of folks in Wyoming, and your story of coming from Iowa. And, you know, you joined us fairly recently in your career. I mean, recent because I am that old. You've been here many years at this point, but really have proved, you know, your past and your history coming from other places and landing in Wyoming, really your passion and your ability to like learn is absolutely fantastic. I can tell you, if I was to go somewhere else in this country, I would not A, know the wildlife, B, know the politics, or C, know the people. And you have really been able to tackle that and just, you know, full force earned the respect of Wyomingites. And that's very admirable. So kudos to you, my dear.
Oh, thank you, Janet. I appreciate that. I think that the trick is, like most of us in our career, what moving from a different state really helped me is I didn't know everything. You find yourself sort of telling staff, you know, we tried that in the past. It didn't work because of this. And so when I came to Wyoming, I had to really step into leadership and lean on the experts and have folks tell me all the different technical aspects. And it really helped me grow as a leader in order to trust those around me. And so, yes, I love to learn. And what better way and place to learn than Wyoming, right? Like, it's been a challenge, but exciting opportunity to learn about things like grizzly bears and wolves and mule deer, all the things, like Drew said, that we don't have in Iowa.
It's funny, when I moved here, so I mentioned that my radio career has taken me to different parts of the country. I moved to Wyoming from California, and people kind of get that butt-tight feel when I say that. But really, it helped me, because as soon as I got here, my first call was to Janet. I'm like, Janet, I want to get involved in Wyoming's outdoor life and the hunting and fishing and all of this. And I think we need to do a show to relay everything you had just mentioned about some people that come here and don't know the regulations. They don't know the season setting meetings. They don't know the process. They don't know the license applications and the fees. And that's what I wanted to do, is learn while we were educating others. And I think with the help of Janet and Brian Olson and Justin Benfit, Matt Hahn, Dan Thompson, another Iowa guy. You know, I mean, it's so cool to kind of learn as we go.
It has been a really neat experience, Drew, but I do want to clarify your first phone call to me was actually about rattlesnake safety. I think you were a little bit concerned about that new development with where you were living, and you wanted to make sure that we got that message out. So for folks who were thinking that you were interested in maybe, like, you know, going hunting or checking out grizzly bears or whatever, it was actually rattlesnakes. So there
right.
you go. Let's put it in perspective.
So the second call I made to Janet that next day was to get this radio show rolling. And obviously, thanks to the director at the time and the governor for, you know, I mean, allowing this to happen. It's a state agency that we have to have the approval of so many people to be able to relay the information. And director, I know that the last year has probably been a whirlwind for you. There's been a lot of things happening, and how has it felt to sit in that director's chair and, you know, make that next step in your career?
Well, you know, I have a lot of friends and family who, you know, read the papers a lot. And so they actually approach me and they're like, how's it going? Almost a sympathetic sort of question. And that always strikes me funny because, you know, I'm always like, it's fantastic. It's going 10 times better than I thought it would, and it's fun. But I think you guys know that we deal with a lot of tough issues. And, you know, there's challenges today. There will be challenges tomorrow. They don't go away. We get new ones. We accomplish some. But I think that's exciting because in this state, we have so much support and so many people wanting to help us that it's not about me alone. You know, we've got 600 people in the department, but then we have the governor who's extremely supportive, legislators who are supportive, our conservation community. And so it's really a group effort. And so I get to feel that every day and constantly getting people proactively coming to me wanting to help. And so challenges, they're there, but it's been exciting and fun. And I look forward to coming to work every single day.
You know, they say if you enjoy working or your job that much, you'll never work a day in your life. And I've had that opportunity to, you know, kind of make those strives to get to a point where, you know, I've had dinner with Garth Brooks. I've been on the road with a lot of country artists, and working and living in Wyoming has been the highlight of my career to this point, just because of what you're saying. There's so many people that are willing to reach out. And I think that is the spirit of Wyoming's outdoor lifestyle.
I think you're spot on, Drew. And I would like to say that while Angie appears not to work every day because she makes it look so easy, the director really, I don't know how she tackles it, like the issues that we deal with in Wyoming and all the things that come along with that can be very challenging. And she really just takes it head on, tackles things. And you can hear she tackles it with such positivity that it makes it, you know, A, great outcomes, and B, you know, very enjoyable. And that's one of the things that we have really benefited from in the agency is her relationships and her ability to collaborate with all of our partners. And it's been really fantastic throughout the agency. You can definitely, you know, feel the changes and the moving forward has been really fantastic. And so we're excited to have her, and the past year has been really good with new you know, outlook on things, and really excited to have her at the top of this agency.
Yeah, Janet had mentioned that you're not new to the agency. You've been there since, 2019, I think, is when you kind of came on board. But when you moved to the director's role in 2024, how long did it take you to feel comfortable in that setting?
Very good question. The first few months, I would say it took me a couple months to feel comfortable. I was lucky that our previous director, Director Nesbitt, gave me a transition time. So I was named director, but then had a couple months before he left me. I would say that I'm not sure how directors just start one day and jump in the next, because I really appreciated that 2 months to get my head wrapped around the level of responsibility, to think about priorities, but more important to think about how to attack those priorities, right? Like how to get that work done. And so the first couple months is a little bit of a foggy memory now. I'm not sure if I can even remember it. However, it didn't take long where I started to feel grounded. One of the things that really struck me odd is everybody wanted to do stuff for me. And I was like, what? I've been doing this for 5 years. I can do this. And I kept thinking, they think I can't do it. And then I had a really good friend of mine who said, no, Angie, that's their role. Did you not do that for the past director? And I'm like, oh, of course I did. So it took me a little bit of a mind shift to say, oh, okay, that's a helpful nature. They're meaning well. They're not like saying I can't do it. They just want to help. So a little bit of a mind shift the first 4 or 5 months before I could handle that piece of it.
And, you know, that's very interesting because you talk about Wyomingites and, you know, you talk about how helpful everybody has been. And so I can only imagine the number of people that really were offering all of their help and, you know, really wanting to interact with you. And I think, you know, that goes to your magnetic personality. And I was talking to Drew about this before the show started is, you know, people want to be a part of that when you have that, you know, leadership style, that personality. And so I can see the hordes of people coming to you and offering all of the assistance in the world. So, but you know, it does take a lot to be reflective on that. And we're happy that you did. And, you know, you talk about your time with the agency before you were a director and people, we've talked a little bit about our habitat protection program, and people may not know a lot about what we've done, but Drew and I are hoping in the future that we're going to do kind of a little series that talks about who the people are in the agency and what they do, because the habitat protection, I think, is one of the most critical positions, and you really headed up that division really well. And how do you feel, Angie, that the habitat protection program, first of all, I guess, what did they do or what do they do? And how do you feel like that prepared you for the directorship?
Oh, yeah. So the Habitat Protection Program will always have, you know, a place in my heart for its work. Very valuable. You know, I did pieces of this in Iowa, but not to the scale that we do it in Wyoming. And we prioritize impacting the habitat across the state. The Habitat Protection Program mostly focuses on areas on public land. With half the state in public ownership, if we truly want to impact our fish and wildlife mm-hmm. services, we need to be very proactive in that. And so Habitat Protection works with developers of all types, oil and gas, solar, wind, counties, anywhere from a rock quarry to drilling, for uranium, work with all sorts of developers. In fact, they get a sense of expertise on these areas and really learn how to work with them. The idea of that section in the department is not to stop development, but really how to work with development to develop in a way that has minimal impact on our fish and wildlife resources. Let me give you an example. I remember this wonderful conversation with a mining company, and we sat down with them. And so imagine this, a table with the biologist and the engineers from the company. So you've got engineer minds, biology minds, you know, sort of talking through what they want to do. And this company was looking at putting various infrastructure on the landscape in kind of a synchronized pattern across the landscape. So a lot of little storage components and huts. And we turned and said, okay. And they thought they were doing really good by making several of these areas, but very small. And we said, we would rather see consolidation of that infrastructure and not little ones across the landscape, but just one larger one. Is that a possibility? And they said, oh my gosh, we would prefer that. We did this because we thought it'd be better for wildlife. And so just the simplest conversations like that, that give and take and understanding each other's specialty can go a huge way. And that's the work that the Habitat Protection Section does, is work one-on-one with these companies, the sooner the better, even when they're just thinking about coming to Wyoming, to impact how they develop. And again, I think the neat thing about that program too is the impacts sometimes seem small, but they're big. And they're thinking about, what does the landscape look like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road, not just today. So it gives an opportunity to work with a type of customer that is not traditional for us. But then one of the surprising things that I took away from that position is how passionate, especially those industry and those companies that live and work in Wyoming, how passionate they were for wildlife and wanted to do the right thing. They just didn't know what that was. And so connecting the individuals really was beneficial.
When you're in a situation like that, because obviously the habitat is so different from the east side of Wyoming to the west side. I mean, it goes from flat to really high. Do you get a lot of these companies that come in that don't really understand that aspect of Wyoming? So it ends up becoming maybe a deeper, darker conversation?
Absolutely. You know, and it can be tricky because if we talk about valuable habitat in the state, the state's covered. It's Wyoming. So we have to prioritize. We have to look at the nuances of where they want to build and think about how we can build in a way that's going to benefit those priority species. With managing over 800 wildlife species in the state, you have to set priorities. So we help them do that and have those considerations. But you're right, there's specific nuances that you'll find in Northeast Wyoming that are much different than Southeast Wyoming. So that's part of our work too, is helping them understand that. And then Drew, being from Iowa, you know that we can clear away the topsoil and we can still restore native prairie in maybe 4 to 5 years. But Wyoming's quite different. You take away that sagebrush ecosystem and you're looking at 25, 50, 75 years before you can restore it. So protecting that, keeping it in place any way, shape, or form goes a lot further than having to come back in and restore it.
Where I hunted for elk this year was in the Red Canyon area where the fire hit. So the 126,000 acres burned where I hunted was directly there. Where last year it was, your truck is hidden from sagebrush, to now it's barren wasteland, it looks like. So that's exactly what you're talking about. Even those resources like fire, which eventually will help the habitat, but still that's going to be 20 to 30 years before it's back to tip-top shape.
Some of it could, you know. I'm anxious to get up there again. I was up there in June looking at some of the rebound from the fire. Greenest landscape I've ever seen in Wyoming. Yeah. It was absolutely gorgeous, the effects responding from some of that fire. Some of that fire moved very quickly across the sagebrush ecosystem. So what we're finding out is it didn't kill the sagebrush, and some of that's rebounding from it. We also did our first ever aerial seeding, trying to restore the sagebrush, out on the landscape. We're still, verdict's still out how well that took hold. So yeah, we don't have a full scale report yet about the quality of habitat coming back in, but fire can be a mixed bag. We see a lot of benefits surrounding years, but then there's areas if they got too hot, burned too long, can have some long-term damaging effects. And then of course, the forest component, right? So some early new growth favors certain species, but then the old growth that we lost a lot of favors species. So there's definitely trade-offs to consider.
When, you know, we talk about sagebrush, obviously the sage grouse is one that Wyoming is very particular to, just from the history and the love and the conservation that has to go into sagebrush or sage grouse and keeping the numbers up as high as we can. And I know we talked earlier this year that the numbers were on a point. They were to the highest point possible. When it comes to looking ahead to habitat restoration or protecting the sage grouse, I mean, what goes into something like that when it comes from the director's chair?
Oh, I spend a lot of my time, Drew, on sage grouse. Very important to this state. You know, we have the largest population left in the world. And we are really the anchor of the West for that population. Our surrounding states have sage grouse, but not to the level that we have. And we've been successful of maintaining that habitat through the work of the three past governors and Governor Gordon, really making it a priority. And why it's a priority, this is when the policy part of my job really comes in, is we work extremely hard in the state to maintain the management authority over this bird. And if their numbers were to drop too low, they would be in jeopardy of being an endangered species. When wildlife becomes threatened or endangered, then it's turned over to our federal government to manage. And the philosophy in the state is the state, the people closest to the resource are the best to manage it. So we work extremely hard at setting policy and perimeters of how we develop in this really critical sagebrush habitat that they use, what's allowed, what's not allowed. When we do move forward with development, what mitigation do folks do so that we're maintaining that habitat? And we keep a very close eye on things. Our staff in this department monitor sage grouse better than anyone else in the world. We, you know, look at every year about 85% plus of those leks and have this incredible database and understanding about what they're doing. Therefore, we can make those really sound decisions because we have such good science and data.
You know, with the data, this year was the first year for the sage grouse permit that everyone that was hunting the sage grouse had to have. Also goes back to help you with data and collecting that information. And that doesn't just stop with sage grouse, because we do the hunting surveys and the creel surveys and all of the information. And I know people that listen to the show a lot get tired of us saying it's not a 2 or 3 month process, is a year round process. And, you know, taking all of that data and put it in into the process is something that is important. And when it comes to things like that, where you're asking for the surveys to be filled out and the on-site data collections like the creel surveys at Glendo, how is that effective in the future of wildlife and habitat in Wyoming?
Oh, Drew, I really appreciate that plug for doing your surveys. I think I have an antelope one in my email box that's waiting for me, too. So definitely important. You know, we're scientists. We could not get enough data. We will never be satisfied. The more, the better. But these are critical elements when we're asking the public to weigh in. So if post-hunting, their harvest surveys, definitely the sage grouse special permit that you need now gives us more of that data. Creel surveys, we're out there talking to anglers, asking them questions. All of this wraps into the baseline knowledge, that scientific basis that we use to continue to offer you, the general public, the best opportunity to engage in using our resource. So not only for population management, but setting our hunting and fishing seasons is critical to have this public input. You know, Drew, over the years, we're seeing less and less public engaged in our public meetings. We still, you know, we have a very good response rate with hunters and anglers filling out surveys. So that's something that we have not seen that decline. But we just continuously encourage, however people feel comfortable, do the surveys, talk to a red shirt in the field, come to a public meeting, send an email. But this information is critical because wildlife management is about managing the populations, but in a way that the public wants. And we need to know what that is. We need to hear from the public to understand their needs and what they want to see.
one of the things that kind of makes my innards a little nervous would be sitting in your chair and having to worry about the politics of it, the science of it, and the public response and reaction of that, and knowing exactly how much of each of it to use when you come into, you know, the decisions that are made, and how deep do you get in each of those areas to come to decisions?
Oh, Drew, you nailed the hardest part of my job. Definitely. That balance, it is really hard for folks. You know, we don't manage wildlife just for wildlife. We have people across the landscape that we consider, and it's our mission, right? Serving people. It can be hard for even our own employees to understand. And I find the public as well. And, you know, I had someone approach me the other day and said, oh, I feel this issue, you're too political. And I said, you know, I Googled what politics is, and it was listening to the people. And I said, but we always should do that. So my job is 100% political. And I think people are okay with it when it matches what they want. It's when it doesn't match what they want that you start to see those sort of words fly around. And so if we can break that down and really dissect it and get to the issue, I think that's really what we owe folks. Let me give you an example. You know, high controversial species in the past and still is in the state with the wolf. People say, if you look at social media at all, you'll hear people that say we should just let them roam freely. And then you have the other extreme, not wanting any wolves on the landscape. My gut is if we did a survey in this state, there'd be an overwhelming support of no wolves in the state. But we do, and we found a way to have them on a landscape in a very managed fashion. Our biologists who manage wolves in the state do an exceptional job of very closely managing in a way that keeps them off the endangered species list, but finds that balance too regarding ranchers and their personal, you know, ranchers have a personal investment in wildlife because it affects their livelihood. And so these decisions are not hard. Somebody told me once, if everybody's mad at me, I'm doing something right. And I think that kind of is, you know, I think wolves really demonstrate finding that balance of, you know, we need them on the landscape. They're part of the landscape. We want them to stay under state management. So how do we do that best way we can with balancing all these issues?
And, you know, you bringing up wolves, the four-letter word, you really did nail it when we talked about, you know, Drew and I often talk about this, the social, the political, and the scientific side of wildlife management. And so you used a very good example there, Director. And so way to nail that question.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting to me when you talk about the biologists that are on the ground doing this work, and to sit across the table from a guy like Dan Thompson. Dr. Dan loves the grizzly bears and all big game like that. And to see the passion in their eyes, and that's what a lot of the public don't get to see, are the fact that on the ground are people that are passionate about the animals, the wildlife, the habitat all over Wyoming. So when they get a controversy like a wolf or a grizzly bear, it's not like nothing's being done. I mean, you guys are working hard to come to every possible measure and get to the bottom of every problem that arises.
Absolutely. We definitely don't take our job lightly, especially when it comes to those, what I call probably hot topic species, right? Grizzly bears, wolves, sage grouse. There's quite a few of them in this state. But at the end of the day, isn't it good that we still have them? And sometimes we just have to remind ourselves of that. We can get frustrated with the politics, with, you know, things not going exactly our way. But it's Wyoming, and you will hear people say things. You know, we recently had a really hot topic, designation of a migration corridor at a commission meeting. And, you know, my good friend, the head of the Petroleum Association, came on and he said, I think this corridor should be designated, but here are the things I want to caution you on. That's remarkable. You know, so we have folks across the different stakeholder groups supportive of what we're doing. They just want to talk more in detail about the nuances of how we do it. So the support is there. Sometimes you just have to look a little bit harder to find it.
You know, you mentioned the migration of mule deer, and, you know, we've had issues with mule deer populations and the pronghorns, low numbers on those, but high numbers of elk. And do you see, as we move forward, where the work on habitat and the work on conservation and crossings for the wildlife to not come in contact as much with vehicles, do you see the future of these animals that maybe are low numbers now coming a little higher and a little better to where we'd like to see those numbers, thanks to the conservation and habitat work?
Absolutely, Drew. I'm pretty optimistic in spirit, and I'm not ready to give up on them yet. You know, let's take mule deer, probably our biggest concern in this state, with the long-term trends continuing to go down. We are seeing good numbers this year rebound from the bad winter of 22-23. However, we're not out of the woods. Our long-term trends do not paint a good picture for mule deer. So definitely want to talk more and do more about mule deer. We're doing a lot. We're focused on habitat. We're focused on wildlife crossings. We're focused on research to understand their movement better so we know where to focus. But this is going to take everyone. This is going to take the state. This isn't unique to Wyoming. It's happening across the West, this concern. And so we are putting together what we call a Wyoming mule deer strategy to really outline all these stresses on mule deer and propose solutions. Some of these solutions are completely outside the game and fish's control. They need to take a look by legislators, by counties, by other individuals who have influence over how we contribute to this population and get them back on track. It's going to take all of us. But what our role is to frame it up. We manage the species. We are the experts. We have the information and knowledge. We need to provide that to everyone else who then can make some actions and decisions about where mule deer go in the state. And I'm hoping this document that we are going to have end of this year, early next year, will do just that, is help paint the picture of what needs to be done. Because some species, like you talked about, Drew, elk are very resilient. You know, we found that out, right? They are adaptable. Those populations can rebound. They're shifting. They're found different places that they weren't found in the past. We probably don't need quite a statewide strategy to increase their numbers. But mule deer is one that we need to put extra attention to and really need to focus on.
And I would like to just point out how fantastic Director Bruce has been. She kind of coined this Migration Matters, which is really a point that we are at right now where we're working really hard to get these highway crossings in to recognize not only the migration of different species and different herds across the state, but also the resident herds as well. Because, you know, we've talked a lot on the show about how sometimes the herds may not do these 200-mile migrations, but it's still just as critical. And so a huge thanks to the director on that. And any of you that have a conservation license plate on your car can kind of thank the director for that. And those of you who don't, you can still purchase them anytime. And right now, with everyone looking at new license plates by the time 2026 rolls around, it's definitely a way that you can contribute to a lot of the efforts that Game and Fish is trying to do on the ground, right? Working with our partners to make a difference in these iconic species like mule deer and the challenges that they are facing across the West. And again, it's not just Wyoming. But I'm really proud and really happy to be a part of an agency that is recognizing that decline and really making some fantastic efforts to improve that species. And so stay in touch, because the beginning of 2026, we'll really be talking a lot about some new and different things that are going on that we can have people help us with across the state.
I think this goes back a lot to folks that aren't in Wyoming don't understand the work that goes into it. And someone that moves into this state probably doesn't realize what goes into everything. You know, we've talked about a lot over the last few minutes about conservation and the programs that are in place and who all you have to work with. But I mean, there are conservation organizations like the Mule Deer Foundation, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Trout Unlimited. You know, you think of some of the walleye clubs throughout who are all striving to work with Game and Fish on all of these projects. None of these agencies or organizations are out to do it on their own. It takes the backing of Game and Fish. And I know that, Director, it sure takes a lot to work with a lot of folks. And you've mentioned having to kind of sit down with some of these organizations and the engineers in a room, you have the biologists in a room, and then you have the hunters in the same room. So it all kind of goes back to the politics, the science, and the public aspect of it. So I know it has to be pretty difficult.
It can be, but, you know, Drew, I'm going to back up a little bit. When I first came to this state, and I go to, so our Westwide Association, so kind of like our professional association meetings, and I got exhausted really quick, and I went to my director. I'm like, oh my gosh, everyone just wants to hear from me. I'm not learning anything. I'm just talking. And because what it dawned on me is Wyoming leads in so many ways. We get things done, and we get things done quickly, and we're looked at as leaders across the West. That was all before I came, so I can't take credit for it, but I got to reap the rewards. And I slowly started to understand the why. And it's what you just said, Drew. It's the process of which we choose to solve problems. We don't come up with the perfect answer and then roll it out and say, here you go, tell us what you think. We bring people to the table at the beginning and we say, this is our shared goal. Now let's come up with the best method to get there. And it works really well, but works even more incredible in this state because other states are doing very similar methods. But the difference I figured out in Wyoming is we're small and we only have 600,000 people. And we have the same, a lot of the same stakeholders around the table if we're working on bighorn sheep issues, if we're working on sage grouse issues, if we're working on migration corridor issues. So we develop the relationships, we develop the process, and we can use it again and again and again because it's the same people. And therefore, we're able to achieve a lot of great things much more quickly than a lot of states can do. And then, you know, building those relationships and trust. When we tackled migration corridors in this state and Governor Gordon chose to do an executive order to protect them, that came from the idea of the Sage Grouse executive order, where someone said, can't we just do the same thing? And because it had a proven track record with everyone being around the table, people were automatically comfortable going in that direction. Did we still have struggles? Yes. Now, there's challenges with all of it, but it gets us to an end result much quicker by maintaining that same process throughout.
And, you know, it is just amazing to watch, to sit back, you know, oftentimes at these commission meetings and things, you know, it often feels like you're going home to family, right? You get to see everybody that you haven't seen in a couple months, these, you know, people that you work with consistently. And, you know, sometimes they're really your enemy and sometimes they're your best friend. And it's still great that even in Wyoming, we're all still fighting for the same thing. And that's what makes it work. and it's fantastic to watch. And so even when someone is on the other side of the fence, you know, the personal relationships are still there. The personal respect is still there. And everyone knows that people are fighting for what they feel is best. And the outcome is always pretty fantastic. And that's what's really good about recognizing the things that are important to people in Wyoming. And Director Bruce does a great job of doing that with her partnerships and policies like she's talking about. And so it's really, it's a pretty fantastic experience. And so, you know, kudos to your relationships, Director, and everyone in Wyoming for sticking with us as we continually, you know, question and challenge a lot of those decisions that are made. We couldn't do it without the non-government organizations, is kind of what we call them, our NGOs, and we couldn't do it without them. So, you know, vice versa, it's pretty fantastic.
Director, as we move forward, I know you're just a year into this role, but how would you like to see the future of partnerships and habitat projects and wildlife management go over the next few years?
Good question. So, you know, I took this first year, and especially the first months of my directorship, to understand what needs to be done. So like any scientist, I've just collected a lot of data. Hugely valuable. And the people to ask, I really turned it inward, internal to the department, and did surveys, did meetings, and heard from folks who knew best what we should do. So this first year, we really focused for the most part on internal things within the department. The stronger that we can be, the more efficient, the more we can increase our capacity with our current staff, the more that we're going to get done when we go anywhere external. And so really focus on internal processes and people, I think will set us up for that next stage. So I'm excited that we're moving into the next stage. We're putting a bow on that first stage, where I'm hoping that we create efficiencies and capacity within our department. We're not going to get any more people. We know that. We're not going to be growing government. So how do we become most effective with the people that we do have? So now that we're going through that and almost at the end, we're going to be turning external. So talking about that mule deer strategy, the plan, we're also going to be looking at habitat and how we can do more for habitat. We do so much, you know. We spend over $10 million with our partners at the table on habitat every year. How can we do it more? Because it's not enough. We are never happy with status quo, but how can we do it in a way that is even more strategic, gets more done on the landscape with our private landowners, with our public landowners, in a way that will benefit wildlife? So we're going to turn our attention to mule deer and to habitat, and really focus on that conversation in 2026.
So the future is looking bright for the habitat, the mule deer, pronghorn. We haven't really talked much about the fishing and angling aspect of Wyoming, because, I mean, that is just as important as the mule deer and the pronghorn, especially when you look at the industries of Wyoming and tourism being one of the top three every year. So the fisheries draw in some of the, you know, outsiders that want to come experience the North Platte River or the chain of, you know, the Snake River and, you know, all the different reservoirs that we have that are known for fishing. And one of the issues that I think that we probably face is when it comes to habitat and safety of our waterways with, you know, some of the aquatic invasive species that some of those surrounding states have been, you know, destined for doom with, you know, that we've been lucky enough so far to have programs in place like the AIS program. And are we looking like these programs are still in the future of Wyoming safe waterways?
Definitely, Drew. Our fisheries in this state are, you know, world renowned. I found it very interesting when I first moved to Wyoming that one of our surveys that we did to the public when we were writing our strategic plan, the results came back that the fishing experiences in Wyoming are what the majority of the folks thought of when they thought of Wyoming. So You know, I would have guessed big game hunting, elk hunting, mule deer, but it was our fisheries. That is very telling. We are reaching so many people with our incredible fisheries, and we need to do everything we can to maintain that. And so you're exactly right with our aquatic invasive species program. We are very nervous. We believe we're doing everything we can to keep that out of this state. But we are actually really nervous about some of our fisheries being cut off because of a lack of a source. So let me explain. We currently get our warm, cool water fisheries, such as our walleye that everybody has grown to love and fishing for, from out of state. That's our source. You know, they used to get some from my home state, Iowa, so I was pretty proud of that. You know, I think they come from Kansas now. But what if these other states, which they have, get infested with zebra mussels and aquatic invasive species? It shuts off our source. We will not take a chance by bringing those fish in. It's too risky. So what we're looking at doing is, how do we become self-sufficient? We're Wyoming, right? That's what we do. We become self-sufficient. We don't like to rely on others. So how can we do that in fish world? And we can do that by creating our own hatchery to grow our own warm water species and not have to be dependent on other states. So right now we're going through a process. It's actually out for bid right now to add an addition onto our Casper fish hatchery that would do just that. The guys have spent several years up there coming up with the skill set to see if we can grow our own, and they figured it out. So we're ready into looking at this phase of bringing it all in-house. Now, our commissioners are very supportive of this. However, we are nervous about that price tag. So this isn't a done deal. We'll be reviewing that this March to see if this is something we can afford to go forward with. But definitely it kind of rounds out the whole picture of protecting us from AIS. You know, we have our active program where we're asking the public to do boat inspections and make sure that we're keeping AIS out of the state. So we need to do our part and make sure we keep it out of the fisheries that we bring into the state as well. And that's what this hatchery is about.
You know, we talked about the Glendo, and Glendo has become a hot spot, especially for the walleye fishermen, where folks will come in from all different parts of the state just to fish Glendo. And the creel surveys that were done this year at Glendo, some were like, oh, it's a pain in my butt to get off the water and have to answer questions. But the information that you're getting is really that great data that guys like Matt Hahn who have been working hard for years to make that one of the best places in Wyoming to fish. So are you learning good things from anglers when you get those creel surveys back?
Absolutely. We're learning about what fish they're catching and everything about them, right? The size and if our management techniques and what we think they should be catching is working. So we're validating our hypothesis like any science would do. But we're also hearing from them. We do want to hear from them. And if they had success, if they were happy with their experience, that's just as important for us to hear, as well as gathering that hard data too.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things, Drew, you talk about the grumbling of people as they're coming off the water. Oh, I have to do this again. But you know, I had the great experience to sit down with our contract fisheries biologist not too long ago and say, okay, how are things going? And she shared with me some of the pictures of her and her crew this summer, the number of people that invited her onto the boat to do the measuring and weighing of the fish, to do the interview questions was so neat to see. And so, like, I guess in my head, I listen to the, you know, 5-10 people that do call and grumble about it, but the hundreds of people that were so happy to have interaction with Game and Fish on that boat ramp or taking her out fishing to actually see how things were going was absolutely fantastic. And so, yeah, I think that all of that stuff matters. And we do love to hear from everybody. And again, it just shows that the squeaky wheel voice that we often listen to may not be the only voice that's out there. And so just remember that sometimes if we make a decision that people aren't hearing about in the public or in the newspapers. It's because we heard from all these other folks as well, but maybe they weren't quite as squeaky. And so it's pretty fantastic that, you know, both the fisheries and wildlife side of things. And again, super lucky to be in Wyoming and be able to experience all of these fantastic habitats and fisheries that we have.
Yeah. And obviously I can't speak for the director, but as a guy that moved here from California by way of Iowa, it's fantastic. It's incredible to be able to cross that state line and the sky's the limit from hunting to fishing to stargazing. I said that earlier. We started the show out with looking at the Northern Lights and not having light pollution and camping and just everything outdoors is fantastic here in Wyoming, and we need to keep it that way. And with the organization, Wyoming Game and Fish Department, I mean, that's the first step in the right direction.
It is. And, you know, the director said some words that really kind of hit home with me. She was talking about anchor of the West. And that was something that I just kind of picked up on and listened to. And Wyoming really is the anchor of the West on so many things, you know, politics, wildlife, habitat, fisheries, and really the people. And I really appreciate her outlook and direction on those things, because it really puts things in perspective. And I think sometimes, you know, when we're on the ground, in the field, in, you know, let's just say Little Shoshone, Wyoming, sometimes we forget about some of those politics and things that we have to deal with on the bigger scale. And we don't understand why some of the things are being made. And that's why I think we can kind of rest assured that we do have those folks that love the politics. And as she defined for us, that means listening to people. But the politics that go into making some of these decisions and you know, rest assured they're made on, you know, good data, good, I don't know, feeling, whatever you want to say. Like, you make these decisions for a reason, and it's pretty fantastic.
And Director, before we let you go, I know that we've covered a lot, and this series is going to be fantastic, and I think people are going to learn so much, not just about your role in the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, but for the future of wildlife. And fishing and just Wyoming in general. But you obviously said that you had an antelope survey in your email. So getting out on the land is something that you enjoy. Has there been a hunt or maybe an outdoor experience that really stands out in your tenure here in Wyoming?
Well, you know, one of the places that tugged at my heart quite a bit and why I ended up here was the Snowy Range. When I was just a visitor, I got to know it quite well. And so it's funny, this September, me and my son climbed it for the 10th annual climb to the peak.
Oh, wow.
So that's a tradition that we started before we moved to Wyoming and just continued. But, you know, it was really those broad, open landscapes. You know those ones where you can see the sagebrush for miles and you can't see a single infrastructure in your path, whole view. And then at the end of the view, you have the mountain range. Those are the ones, no matter where I am in the state, that just really still give me goosebumps. It makes me feel like a visitor. But, you know, definitely I just get outside every weekend, no matter what it is, I have to get outside. But I have found my favorite is antelope. I think they're the symbol of Wyoming. They're very iconic, incredible creatures. And I love the sort of predator prey aspect of it. I truly feel like a predator when I'm after them. I didn't get that, you know, with whitetails or pheasants in Iowa. So I feel like a true hunter and love that feeling. So I'm pretty happy as long as I'm outside, but enjoy trying new things as well.
That was my exact thought this year on my elk hunt was I was up on a 7,000-foot peak looking out, and you could see the bighorns all the way over to the Absorcas. And, you know, you could see just that plain in the middle. And like you said, you get the different aspects of view. Every 10 minutes, if you're driving, you get something different. I love that part about Wyoming, too.
just to sum up the conversation a little bit, we've done this series, Drew, and I would just like to point out, first of all, that the director is the first director that has agreed to come on the show with us and kind of talk a lot about these issues. And just to give folks some background about, you know, what the director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department means. So in Wyoming, with the Game and Fish Department, we have a commission that is appointed by the director. They're our decision-making body. So we have the department, we have the commission, and then we have the governor and the director. And the director is actually appointed by and serves for the governor. And so it's really a privilege to have her here and that relationship that she has with the governor to really be on the ground making a lot of these policy decisions and interacting with us. And as we've heard over this series, how much the director really does work with folks on the ground, whether you're within the agency or a government, a non-governmental organization like the Muley Fanatics, or whether you're a landowner. And so it really is special to have her here. And, you know, as always in Wyoming, just a phone call away. And that's one of the things that's been really great about Director Bruce is I can remember we were at Mule Deer Days last year and this individual came up to me and he was like, "Are you Angie?" And I was like, no, not even close. Low man on the totem pole here. But the words that he had to say about the director and he told the story about, "I didn't know what to do. She picked up the phone and called me after I had a concern and I had called her." And he was just talking about the impact that that had. And so I just want to make sure that people recognize that here in Wyoming, you know, as I sit here and have been smooching her rear end the entire show, it really is about the fact that she's very approachable. Right? She's very much a phone call away. And Wyomingites really can rest assured that we're in great hands. And if they have any concerns or questions, like we always say on the show, we're always a phone call away. And the director is as well. Even though she's serving at, you know, the pleasure of the governor and answering to all of these other commissioners and trying to balance all of this, it's a super fantastic honor to have her here and listen to her perspectives and know that as we go forward for the next several years that she's in this position, that we'll be in good hands.
Well, Director, we do appreciate you coming on. It's been an honor. It's been fun. It's been nice to rub elbows with another Iowan. And pass on to the governor that we love that he appointed you to be director and that, you know, we look forward to big things coming from you.
Great. Thanks to both of you. I'm flattered. Janet, yes. Thank you for the compliments. It's truly an honor to work with the staff here in the department. Great show today. Drew, glad to be on. I love the humor sprinkled in as well. Looking forward to maybe a future show as well.
Hunting season is in full swing, and now is the time to get stocked up at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. With Casper's largest selection of guns and ammo, it's easy to be prepared. Don't forget the game bags, backpacks, culls, and camouflage. Rocky Mountain Discount Sports carries products from all the top manufacturers, such as Vortex, Leopold, Badlands, Hornady, Primos, and more. Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, CY Avenue, and Casper. Thanks for shopping Wyoming first at your Wyoming-owned and operated Rocky Mountain Discount Sports.
When looking for places to live in Wyoming, you'd be hard-pressed to find another ranch that offers as much as B.B. Brooks. The B.B. Brooks Ranch is conveniently located in south-central Wyoming in Natrona County, near the historic town of Casper. The spirit of the American West can now be yours at B.B. Brooks Ranch. For the first time, this historic property is being offered in a stunning 40-acre parcels. Don't miss a chance to buy a Wyoming ranch for sale near Casper and stake your claim. Visit WyomingDreamland.com.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.